From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made on November 4th, 2008, Election Day. Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama had hoped for a massive turnout from younger voters to help him carry him to victory. His team was privately confident, but they knew that younger voters can be unreliable. By the time the polls closed, the Obama campaign knew that young voters had turned out in large numbers. Tufts University found that 2 million more voters under the age of 30 cast ballots in 2008 as compared to 2004. So how's turnout looking for this year's presidential race? The short answer, not good. A Gallup poll found that only 47% of Americans age 18 to 34 say they will definitely vote on November 8th. So what happened? Millennials are often described as selfish, lazy, and politically disengaged, but so-called millennial movements like Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter prove that this is untrue. Just look at the Sanders campaign. Bernie Sanders won more votes among those under age 30 than Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump combined. Millennials are more educated, tolerant, and progressive than previous generations. And at about 75 million strong, they could be a deciding factor in this year's presidential race if they turn out at the polls. So, is it about the candidates and their often nasty campaigns? Is it the issues? Or is there not enough outreach? Could it be tied to long-held frustrations with unemployment or underemployment? Our guests will discuss all of these questions this hour and what it might take to get young voters to the polls. Again, we've got less than 2 weeks, and we have a full panel to talk about it with us. I'd like to welcome my guest. Illy Ali is a bartender at Turcotte's Tap Room. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Jessica Lewis is the principal publicist and owner of La Lu Public Relations. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you.
Hoodie Miller is a youth educator and garden manager for the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. Nice to see you again.
Hello, hello.
And BJ Scanlon is a local Democratic activist. Thanks for coming back, BJ.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
And joining us on the phone is Dr. Ruth Milkman, a distinguished professor of sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center. Dr. Milkman, thank you for taking the time.
It's my pleasure.
So Dr. Milkman, I'd like to start with you. One of your areas of expertise is in the so-called millennial movements, and you study the ways in which millennials are engaged in both political and social issues. Now, looking at the current political climate, are you surprised by the current state of the youth vote?
Well, not particularly, no. I think the conclusions, though, that people are drawing from it are a little bit misleading, in that while millennials may not be that interested in voting in an election like the one that's coming up in a couple weeks, they are very politically engaged in other arenas.
And some of those that you address in your publications are Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, the Dreamers, and the anti-sexual assault movements. Do you think that
I was just going to say, yes, all four of those are led by millennials. They're the overwhelming majority of activists in all four.
Do you think that any of those movements in particular will have an impact on the youth vote, maybe one over another based on how they're organized?
It's really hard to say. None of them are really focused on electoral politics. They're focused on other issues. So, you know, I don't think there's a straight line you can draw from those movements to the election. The one exception to that was during the primaries when millennials supporting Sanders in such vast numbers, many of them did come from those movements, but they're less enthusiastic about Clinton, and many see the two-party system as problematic, et cetera. So some will vote, and they, insofar as they do, I think they will vote overwhelmingly Democratic, but you know, it's a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. I'll open that up to our in-studio panel. Are any of you involved in any political or social movements, and has that impacted how you feel about the current election?
I'm involved in the Black Lives Matter movement, and it definitely has affected how I view this election, specifically with the way Trump tries to portray people of color. In the recent debate, he referred to African Americans as the blacks, talking about how they were living in slums and in poverty, when in reality, not all African Americans or people of color are living in poverty. And there's so many scholars and people who are just working towards getting rid of that stigma, and it kind of just, a man who could be running our country is speaking down about a whole group of people as if we're all struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And the president of our country is a man of color, so there are people who are working hard to change that stigma, and it just kind of really, really hit home for me. Coming from a background where my parents came all the way from Africa, I'm half Somalian, half Egyptian. My father worked to help the police in translating and became a police officer and then a federal agent. So for him to just stigmatize people as lesser, basically, it's just not okay.
Do you plan to vote?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't be for Trump.
Anyone else want to jump in?
Sure. sorry about that. I became engaged in the political scene in the Rochester area as soon as I came to the community. I had originally come to do some volunteer work through the Rochester AmeriCorps program and sort of began working with some of the youth in poverty and with a homeless youth shelter. And I became sort of inspired to try and make more of an impactful policy-based change in our own community. So I started working on campaigns for city council, for state elected offices, and really concentrating some of my work on doing some local activism, trying to get people registered to vote, and also supporting candidates that I think have progressive and liberal views that will help push our country and our communities further.
And do you plan to vote on November 8th?
I haven't missed an election since I turned 18, Megan.
Good for you. How about you, Hoodie? Is this the first presidential election you can vote in, or is it your second?
It's my second, but I don't plan to vote this year.
You don't? Why not?
Because they use, like, unprofessional methods, you know, to get to each other, and I don't want our, like, future watching us pick between two who use such methods, you know?
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about any of the third-party candidates?
I mean, like, I feel like we all have a lot of growing to do, but as far as this year, I don't want to be in that mix, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jessica?
I do plan to vote. Although, you know, there's many problems with both of the candidates, you know, people have voiced that on social media, major media channels. I think that it's important that we exercise our right to vote. Being a person of color, I know what my ancestors and those before me went through just to have that right. And so I think that it's my duty, personally, to vote.
Dr. Milkman, in your research, do you find that this is common, some of these responses?
Yeah, I do. I think, again, there's not a single Trump supporter in this group, which, you know, it's a very small group, so that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But I think the support for Trump is at best in the single digits among this generation. And so the question really is whether they're going to vote at all. And for Clinton's sake, it would be nice if they did, given that we don't really know what mm-hmm. the election, you know, how close it's going to be. But I'm not surprised at all by their responses, no. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the literature that's out there and the polls of this generation, everything shows that they are way to the left of older people. So it's hardly a surprise that there's no support for Trump. And, of course, although he hasn't attacked millennials per se, he's attacked so many of the groups that millennials care about that, you know, it would be very surprising if there were any support in this mm-hmm. group or in the broader population of the generation.
Jumping to some of those social triggers that you discuss in your work, are there any in particular that you think apply to this very current generation of millennials, especially in light of this recent election?
Yeah, well, so I'm not sure what you mean by triggers, but the things that have shaped this generation are many, and one of the most important is one that Trump actually does talk about a lot, which is the transformation of the labor market and the disappearance of desirable jobs. He attributes that completely to trade, which I don't think is accurate, but that has really affected the millennial generation, who face a labor market full of things like internships and short-term contracts and jobs as independent contractors with no benefits and freelancing and all the rest of it. I mean, older workers face that too, but it has a much bigger impact on people just entering the labor market for the first time. So that is a huge thing, and I think has contributed to the sense that, you know, there's something wrong with the United States as it stands now. That has led to both the social movements that we talked about before and, you know, this sort of left-leaning generational orientation. So that's one factor. And then another is the internet revolution this is less directly related to the election maybe, but I think very important in those movements that I mentioned before. Millennials were born with the internet. It was there when they were born. They're what some people call digital natives, unlike somebody my age. I'm a baby boomer who had to learn about it and is still technologically challenged in some areas, and many people of my age are. So that means that communicating by social media is just second nature for this generation, and that's been really vital to the generation of the various social movements that the generation has been active in, and to mobilizing folks and ongoing communication in between actions and so on. So that's another factor, and there are more, but I probably should stop there and give other people a chance.
No, you're fine. Anyone want to jump in on those comments? Illy, I know you were talking about social media before we were live, and how you're having some awkward conversations with people on Facebook.
Yeah. Specifically, a few of my friends have been posting, delete me if you're voting for Trump, delete me if you're voting for Hillary. I grew up in Virginia and moved to upstate New York recently, about 5 years ago, but I like to say recently. and so I have two different groups of people, two different demographics, friends who are living overseas, friends who've moved to Canada for school. And I've never really posted delete me if you believe this way, because I feel like it's important to have open discussions. I've really asked this question many times, specifically to females that I know on Facebook who are Trump supporters. How can you stand behind him, especially when you walk down the street and men are catcalling you and he's saying basically that the things that he said, which were pretty profane, are locker room talk. First, what sports does Trump play? And second, how is that okay? How are we telling women to be more body positive and stand up for themselves when a man who is running for president is degrading women? And specifically, women... Sorry, I'm having a moment.
It's okay.
These women aren't able to really say anything back to me other than, oh, well, Hillary's a crook, or Hillary deleted all these emails. And it's just, there's really nothing that they stand behind other than Clinton or Bill Clinton did this, or what about when Bill did that to Monica? Well, Bill's not running for president. So it's just important to have open dialogue about these things and be able to see varying opinions. And like you said, Hoodie said earlier, you're not voting. I'd like to know why people aren't voting and know their opinions instead of just being like, well, I'm going to delete you because you don't agree with me. Mm-hmm. So,
does anyone use social media to mobilize people who may not be voting or maybe unsure and you feel strongly about a political cause?
I wouldn't say that I use social media, but what I'm looking at, Megan, is a lot of folks are looking at this election as being specifically between Trump and Hillary, but that's the top of the ticket, and there are so many other elections. So I'm going to encourage you to, if you don't want to vote for the president, please go and look at the host of other races that we have. We have a congressional race in our community that was won by less than 1,000 votes 2 years ago. It's a very tight race. The same candidates are running again. I think that we need to keep progressive voices like Louise Slaughter in office. She's one of only a handful of people with a science degree in Congress that is able to actually process and understand the information that's coming from a scientific perspective. I think we're looking at a clerk race that is extraordinarily close. We haven't had a Democrat in the clerk's office or in county government, with the exception of the district attorney, in a very long time. And we've seen Adam Bello find quite a few items that the previous clerk's offices have not maybe done on the up and up. We have state assembly, state senate races. We have city court and county court races. There are a ton of elections that are happening in our community this year and every year. We don't just have an election every 4 years. So if you're not going to vote for the president, that's your prerogative. But please at least look toward the other races and realize that this is happening. And that's sort of the message. I mean, I'm not a huge user of social media, and I know that I've sort of steered the conversation a little bit away from that. But in my casual conversations with people, this is sort of the message I'm trying to push, you know. And just to keep up one more time, I know we've talked a little bit about the movements and folks like Occupy and Black Lives Matter. And the one office that I think really has the most impact on the goals and missions of that movement isn't the presidency, it's the Supreme Court. And we have an open Supreme Court seat, which Congress is refusing and the Senate is refusing to fill. And whomever is elected president is going to be making at least one Supreme Court appointment. And if you want to look at the tying in of movements to the political scene, nothing is more tied in than it is through the decisions of the Supreme Court. So I think if you want to use social media to mobilize people, I think this is our biggest talking point for the generation to see a positive social movement.
Sure, go ahead.
And I just want to say that I want to encourage people to make sure that you educate yourself on the platforms of the various candidates who are running. Oftentimes, we base our thoughts and opinions based on what others have said, and so we're taking what people are posting on Facebook and Twitter as gospel. And we really need to make sure that we educate ourselves so that when it's our time to go to the ballot, we know who we're voting for and why we're doing that. For millennials, you know, we have the opportunity to make a lot of change, but we have to do so in strategic ways. And we have to make sure that, you know, we're putting ourselves out there, you know, on the front lines and run. There's no reason why there has to be a certain demographic of people constantly running for office.
Okay. Related to that, we received an email from Matt earlier today who wanted to stress the importance of local elections as well. And he said a great resource that has really helped him is ballotpedia.org. He says you can simply put in your address and it shows you all of the candidates running for offices and those that you can vote for in your area. It gives a backstory and links to topics regarding them. He says, please implore your listeners to vote locally, even if they hate the presidential candidates. So thanks, Matt, for your email. So ballotpedia.org, if you aren't familiar with that. I'm seeing the phone starting to ring, and we will get to your calls in just a moment. Dr. Milkman, I know you need to go soon, so I have one more question for you.
Okay.
In your work, you speak about the dominant narrative about millennials. If you can tell us a little bit about that and then whether or not you think it's fair, and then I'll open that up to our panel as well.
Well, so this may be a little out of date, but in general, the media portray millennials as selfish, spending all their time on the screen, you know, narcissistic, living at home with their parents and not, like, seriously engaged in adult life, that kind of stuff. And the digital native thing is there, too, which I don't think is really in question, but that's part of it as well. And the living at home with parents actually is at a higher rate since any time since World War II. But that, of course, reflects the economic picture that's out there that millennials face, which is that housing is extremely expensive and wages are very low for entry-level jobs. So there's no mystery about what's going on there. It's not, you know, a reflection of narcissism or anything like that. The other stuff, though, I think is nonsense, the selfish, narcissistic, et cetera, kind of. Young people of every generation are sort of seen that way by their parents and older people as, you know, this new generation, we don't understand them. I remember this when I was a young person. It's just a kind of standard disdain for the, you know, the music and the culture and so on of the young. So I don't think there's really any basis for that. And the other stereotype that's out there is one of political disengagement. And again, I think that's very misleading, as we already discussed, that the engagement just takes a different form than it does for older parts of the population.
And what do you see for the future? Will there be another Black Lives Matter movement, something related to that?
Well, I don't think Black Lives Matter is going away, by the way.
Right.
Occupy did go away, so that one's, you know, basically history, although the individuals involved in it, many of them have gone on to do other kinds of social justice activism, so they're, you know, the movement may not be there in that form, but the people are. And I think that you're going to see, it's not everybody who's a millennial, obviously, but there's a substantial part of the generation that is committed to political activism of one sort or another, and that may give rise to new movements, and it may, you know, lead to growth of the existing ones. Three of the four that I studied are still very much alive and well. The Dreamers, which is young undocumented immigrants who I think are hopeful that once again there may be some action on immigration reform after the election, depending, of course, on who wins. And Black Lives Matter is very vibrant still. And if anything, the election campaign with all the scandals about Trump's
views of women and behavior toward them has given new fuel to the anti-sexual assault movement. So I see all those as kind of vibrant, growing enterprises, and millennials are at the helm in all three.
I'm seeing a lot of nodding in our studio. Anyone want to weigh in on that? You don't have to. It seems we're all in agreement, and I think that, you know, we seem to be heading in the right direction. Dr. Milkman, do you think that 40% projected number for turnout will serve to be untrue? Do you think that number will actually increase once we hit November 8th, or are you a little pessimistic about turnout?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's very hard to predict these kind of things, and I don't have any expertise on election turnout. I do think whether they vote or not, that millennial generation youth can be counted on to be a progressive force, though, in the future, and that's one of the few things that gives me hope these days, because they are the future, after all. This is the young generation that's going to be taken over from us. So,
we're talking about youth votes and the millennial movement here on Connections today, and I'd like to take our only break of the hour and get back to your phone calls. But first, I'd like to thank Dr. Ruth Milkman for joining us. She's a distinguished professor of sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center. Dr. Milkman, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you very much, and happy Halloween to everybody.
You too. We'll be back with more Connections in just a moment. And remember, if you would like to join the conversation, you can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program, and my email address is mmack@wxxi.org or connections@wxxi.org. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter at mmackmedia. We'll take our short break, and we'll be right back with more on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, how much screen time is safe for babies, toddlers, tweens, and teens? We live in a 24/7 digital media world, and sometimes we don't realize how much media we actually consume, or how much media our kids consume, even as infants. The American Academy of Pediatrics has released new screen time recommendations for kids. We'll break those down and answer your questions. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about the youth vote and millennial movements, and I have a full panel today. Ilya Ali is a bartender at Turcotte's Tap Room. Jessica Lewis is the principal publicist and owner of La Lu Public Relations. Hoodie Miller is a youth educator and garden manager for the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. And BJ Scanlon is a local Democratic activist. I'd like to get right to your calls, and we'll start with Beth in Brighton. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Megan. I have two issues. One, I went to school in Boston, lived in St. Louis. There was no way I could vote because there was no way that I had a home address that, you know, that was in Boston. It was a dorm. Okay, that's an issue that I think someone needs to address. The second is the funniest. If you are in Texas, your ID card for college is not accepted, but your hunting card is. Only in Texas would this happen. And I think it's just worth a laugh, if nothing else. Anyway, thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you, Beth. BJ, I can tell you have opinions.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Sure. So the first issue was talking about an inability to vote. And that is an issue in some communities, but we do have absentee voting. I think that the time may have elapsed currently in New York to do absentee voting. But in 37 states across the country as well, there are options for early voting, and some of them are starting. It's another option for folks, and we've seen a lot of the Latino and Latinx community coming out and voting in larger numbers than ever before, especially in Florida. And then when we're looking at the Texas issue that Beth had mentioned, where your hunting ID is a valid ID for voting, but your college ID is not, I think it's very clear that those are methods that are used to dissuade potentially liberal or democratic voters who are in college in higher percentages versus that of people who are gun owners, which are maybe a higher percentage of Republican or conservative voters. And it seems very much like a partisan tactic.
Mm-hmm. We could do a whole show on voter suppression, but there's a timely news element here. Yesterday, Bloomberg reported that a senior Trump official has said that the campaign currently has three major voter suppression operations underway. And one of them involves delivering anti-Clinton messages through Facebook dark posts. I'm not sure if the panel has heard about those. But it says the campaign will now target that voter demographic on Facebook, meaning African Americans. This refers to television ads that the Trump campaign was releasing on African American radio stations. So these Facebook posts will deliver an animated clip that mimics Clinton's 1996 line in which she called African Americans, quote unquote, super predators. And the posts themselves are essentially unpublished posts that appear in the news feed, but not on the page itself. And it allows campaigns to communicate directly with certain individuals. So, I mean, we've heard a lot about voter suppression and voter intimidation in the last couple weeks. How do any of you feel about that? We have diversity on the panel. Do any of you feel unsafe going to the polls?
I definitely don't feel unsafe, but this kind of goes back to my point about, you know, being educated. We should be educated consumers of media, social media. So any of these messages that are coming through, whether through dark posts or whatever, we have to know how to sift through that. You know what I mean? I don't know who they think, you know, this is really going to impact in such a way, you know, to persuade people to vote one way or the other. But I think this generation is definitely, we know how to think for ourselves. We have our own platforms, our own, you know, things that we care about. And so these tactics aren't new. They've been doing these types of things since literacy tests, you know, in the 60s. So these are just different kinds of ways that they're trying to do it now. And really, I just don't think it will have that much of an impact.
Mm-hmm. If anything, it kind of shows how desperate they are to get votes and dissuade people from voting a certain way. So it's just sad and pathetic tactic. So I don't think anybody's going to fall for it. Mm-hmm. At least I hope they don't. Sorry.
No. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Sarah's been waiting a while. Sarah in Rochester, you are up next.
Hi, Megan. Thank you so much for having me on the air. My question was partially answered by BJ Scanlon, so thank you for that, BJ. There seems to be a lot of focus on the presidential candidates regarding this upcoming election, and I'm wondering if millennials are informed as to the power and significance of the judicial and legislative branches of government, how they impact the creation and interpretation of our laws and policies, and how they, in turn, impact the future of our nation.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
I want to respond to that. The reason why most people probably aren't is because of what we're being fed. So much of what we're seeing is focusing on the presidential election that, you know, the other areas are just getting left out. You know, there's not a lot of light being shown on this. And so it's almost kind of like if it's not right in your face, you don't even really address it. You don't even really think about it.
I also think that part of what we're looking at is a presidential election is almost always contentious. There's always the opportunity for one side to win over the other. But when you're looking at a lot of our legislative districts, so many of them are rooted in population areas that are decidedly conservative or liberal. So oftentimes you'll have maybe one candidate on the ballot, or you'll have candidates on the ballot that are favored to win at over 80%. So when we're looking at our legislative races, they're not necessarily as competitive. In our community, we definitely have a more competitive race that people should be out voting for in our congressional race for our House of Representatives member. And I would encourage them to look into Louise Slaughter and consider voting for her. On our senatorial side, we don't have a competitive race. Chuck Schumer is running against Wendy Long, and people don't even know Wendy Long is running on the Republican side. So when you're looking at our legislative branch, we're not necessarily having as many discussions in that case because New York has had Democratic senators for such a long time. Our judicial races are even harder because how do you know what makes a good judge? You have to go based on the reviews of different communities that are already in the legal profession. So lawyers and lawyer and groups rate and give ratings to the judges. Judge races are 10-year or higher appointments. So they're not, and they're also not allowed to be super political. So they're not allowed to give some information on what their opinions are on things. They can really only run on their credentials. So when you're looking at elected judge races, it's very difficult. When you're looking at legislative races, a lot of times they seem to be already decided. So I think that's why there's so much more focus on the executive race at the top of the ticket.
I think you all bring up a number of good points. And I'll say that regarding the race with Chuck Schumer, we've invited Senator Schumer on the show, I think, since Evan started in 2004. And I don't believe that he's ever participated. But this year we did have Alex Merced, the Libertarian candidate for that seat, and also Robin Laverne Wilson, the Green Party candidate. So if you're interested in learning more about these candidates, they each had a significant amount of time on this show. So feel free to check our archives and listen to those broadcasts if you'd like to learn more. Because you're right, I think we get stuck talking about how nasty campaigns can be, and we get stuck in rhetoric, but we don't have time to talk about actual issues. And one issue that really hasn't been addressed in any of the presidential or vice presidential debates is climate change. And I know Tim in Rochester wants to weigh in on that, so we will go to Tim. Hi, Tim.
Yes, hi, Megan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to ask the panel what their reflections are on the degree of involvement of millennials in the climate change issue. So I think of people like Bill McKibben and the scale of training that he's been doing over the last several years, especially focused on young people. So I'm just curious. I would have been interested in the professor's thoughts on that as well, but what is their take on the degree of engagement of millennials in climate change activism?
Okay. Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, good.
Is anyone involved in local climate change activities? Oh, honey, go ahead. Yes.
Last year, I was a school climate champion.
Oh, good for you. Okay, tell us a little bit about that.
It just to have that feeling of knowing that you're making a difference, and to the point where the district knows, like, hey, we want to notify you for just doing exactly what you're supposed to be. It feels great, you know?
So what are some of the activities that you participated in, or some of the initiatives that you helped bring forward?
Well, this year we started a help zone. Well, it's not the first year, but most schools around here in Rochester, we have a help zone at Monroe, one at Wilson, one at 19, 17, and 50 as well, where we're just trying to just spread that positive energy and just keep it on a level where we can teach nonviolence in all schools, and all schools have trainings to do mediations and peace circles.
Mm-hmm. When we look at climate change, Megan, especially at the top of the ticket, we see that one of the candidates believes it exists and the other thinks that it is a hoax that is generated by China. So I think when we're looking at the issue of climate change, we see a real divide between Democrats and Republicans is parties. And I also think locally we have some of our city government is doing a lot to work on creating some solar farms in previously abandoned lots. The city has an entire green initiative, and I think that we're seeing a lot of this happening potentially because we have very liberal viewpoints on our council and in our mayor's office. I also think that climate change is an issue that is very that a lot of young people are passionate about. I'm myself not immediately involved in a climate change organization, but definitely have sympathies toward folks who believe that it exists and are trying to reduce carbon emissions.
And I think that weighs into what Jessica was saying. Do your research. And we had a candidate for the 133rd Assembly District on the show yesterday who said that global warming is not real. They made it up. It was on the news. And that was a source of debate on the panel. So again, research is important, especially in this election where, again, we are not really delving into issues as we have in past elections. Tim, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Just a final thought would be adding actually to what you're saying, Megan, about research, the scenarios that the International Panel on Climate Change have generated, 97% of all climate scientists have signed onto this are pretty serious for the long term. And yet, at the same time, there are things that we can do in terms of mitigation and adaptation policies that can limit the forecasted severe impacts. And there's a lot of enormously creative things happening both around the country and around the world. So this is a long-term issue that people don't feel, you know, initially that deeply connected with. But to engage in what is actually known in terms of global warming, and to begin to look at what are the ways that we can begin to both reduce emissions and grow the economy, because unless we do both at the same time, we might as well not be at the table. Those things are critical. And I'm with an organization called Citizen Climate Lobby, which has a proposal to put a price on carbon in a way that would reduce emissions significantly beyond what the president has proposed so far with the Clean Power Plan. But it would also grow jobs, 2.8 million over 10 years in this new transitional period to different sources of energy, to new sources of energy, so or ancient sources of energy in terms of wind and solar. So anyway, I think it's really important to take the opportunity at this point in time to take some kind of responsibility for the future, for us all, children and grandchildren and animals and life on Earth.
Thank you, Tim. Yeah, absolutely. And Tim is involved in the People's Climate Coalition. So if you want to learn more about efforts that are going on locally, you can check out their website, People's Climate Coalition of Rochester. Back to the phones. Let's stay in Rochester. And we are speaking with Quinesha. Hi, Quinesha.
Hi, how are you guys? Hey, Jessica.
Hi.
So I just wanted to comment on millennials and our participation in politics, government, et cetera. And say, I think that with our generation, what's different is that a few things. One, we don't have a centralized voice like previous generations. And I think that the generations prior to us are kind of looking at us and wondering how that's possible and probably pretty confused by it. So we don't have a Martin Luther King of this generation. We have several people that are asserting their voices through social media and saying, hey, these are the issues that matter to me. And the other side of that coin is that these are a lot of issues because we only had centralized voices in previous generations. A lot of these issues were not discussed because you have things like intersection. So when you had a basically male voice leading, then you didn't talk about black women's issues. You talked about black people's issues, not understanding that there are layers beyond just the black man and his issues and confrontations with police. Beyond that, I think that what I would love to see in our generation is that we would take up this down ballot situation. Because I think that a lot of our powers are being lost and our voice being lost because we don't get the voices that represent us in office, like the person that came on the radio yesterday and said completely false things. And another thing that I'm kind of talking about on Twitter as it relates to yesterday's conversation is I really wish that we'd have more people that would stand up in the moment and call out things that are false as false and not just say he said things that people didn't like, because we know that they were patently wrong. And the way that he painted not only neighborhoods, but entire swaths of communities and individuals, completely false, and at his core, blatantly racist. So there was a lot of dog whistle that happened yesterday. So I think that if we had more folks that recognize that this generation is not a centralized voice, and that when things happen like what happened yesterday, we are going to call you out for it, because we are not afraid of one person being, you know, disenfranchised by us saying that this was wrong, this was racist, this is false. So I would love to see more of that reflected in public radio in the moment of these things being said, that they be challenged and people like him not be invited back in an attempt to try to give both sides of the equation, because when there's a falsehood, you don't really need someone to represent the false side. You really just need the facts to be shared. So that's my perspective, which was a lot there.
Thank you. Thank you, Quinesha. So if you missed the program yesterday, Joe Arrigo, who is the Republican candidate for the 133rd Assembly District, he's vying for Bill Nogé's seat. He was on the program yesterday with Barbara Bear, who's the Democratic candidate, and Mr. Arrigo made some comments that I don't want to devote a lot of time to this because the show is about millennials and I don't want to give more attention to a show that is still a developing story and that we plan to follow up with in the future. But to Quenisha's point, yes, if you have questions about that show, that podcast is available online. You can hear his statements for yourself. We do plan to follow up with him because we feel it's important to... We get to a point in conversations sometimes where people believe things that are untrue or irrational. And that was our first hour yesterday, which is an interesting fit. But
Megan, if I could talk a little bit to Quenisha's point.
Sure, sure.
And one of the things that she had said, and this is definitely not the focus of her point, was that maybe you should consider not inviting him back on. And I just think that this is not necessarily a perspective I agree with. You should never be denying people access to hear what elected officials or people vying for elected office, especially as one of the major party candidates, have to say. And I think when they say what they say, it gives us a good perspective on what their opinions and beliefs are. Now, what Quenisha was really talking about was the fact that millennials don't have a centralized voice. And I couldn't agree with her more. There are so many movements, and I think the panel here probably is all members of different types of movements that are happening in our community, be they like peace efforts through the Gandhi Center. I'm sure you do a lot through social media. And as a bartender, the things you must hear, I can yeah, only definitely. Imagine. But we had actually heard a little bit about intersectionality in identities that people aren't just identifying with one group. There's so many parts that make us a whole human. And I know that it's hard to not focus on the things that are your minority status, and it's hard to not focus on the things that are so important to you. As a member of the LGBT community myself, I know that I do a lot of work with gay youth and queer youth, and I think that that is a really driving force for some of the work that I'm doing. And I would assume that folks here might be working with organizations that help provide purpose and identity and identity development for people who are younger than you and maybe older than you that have the similar identities. And I think that when we're working with each other, and it's so hard to find a commonality because our community in our country is becoming more and more diverse, and we have different identities, and not all folks who used to be blanketed into one group continue to be. And I think Quenisha hits that point on the head.
Absolutely. And that's something that Dr. Milkman focuses on in her research as well, is that concept of intersectionality. And Illy, I know you wanted to talk about some of the work that you do, so I think this is a good time to talk about your activism.
So feminism is supposed to include everyone. And recently we've been hearing a lot about transsexual people wanting to use bathrooms, if like male, female bathrooms. I actually frequent Lux, and there's a sign up that says it doesn't matter what you identify as. If the bathroom is open, you may use it. And I've stood in line and had discussions with people about their sexual identity. And I have friends that prefer they and them pronouns. And just being able to respect that. And while intersectional theory was originally meant to address the unique intersection of oppression faced by Black women, it's since opened up to include those with disabilities, mental illness, non-Western religious identities, non-white ethnic or racial identities, non-thin bodies, non-Eurocentric. I could go on and on. And the one thing that brings us all together is sexism, racism, and classism, and wanting to get rid of all of that. So just because somebody doesn't identify with something you're familiar with doesn't mean you can't respect them for it. And the main thing, like you were saying earlier, we just have to come together and respect each other in order to move on for the greater good.
Mm-hmm. Totally agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hoodie, would you like to elaborate? Move a little closer to your mic. There you go.
It's just, I never heard somebody speak on it with so much like with the care. And I thank you for that. I feel the same way.
Mm-hmm. And I think that part of the millennial generation is having, at least in our community in Rochester, is having exposure to more people who are different than us. And so we tend to be maybe a little bit more inclusive. And that's not to say that people of older generations aren't as inclusive, but I think a lot of it is with such access to the internet to access people who are like us and learn about differences and be able to embrace them at an earlier age, that it has really impacted people's ability to sort of come together in ways that are embracing a fabric of diversity.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about confirmation bias for a moment, a Pew Research study indicated that 65% of people who follow political figures on social media follow people who agree with what they believe. Only 3% follow people who have different perspectives. So that's something that is important, too, to open yourself up to different opinions so you can better inform yourself. I'll try to post that on Twitter later if I can track down that graph. We have a couple of emails I'd like to address. One is about millennial shaming. It comes from Kat in Rochester. And she said, I just wanted to bring up my feelings as a millennial about millennial shaming. I'm a 25-year-old college-educated person who is living paycheck to paycheck while working for a well-regarded organization in our community. When a candidate was running for the nomination who supported millennials and received millennial support, wanting to bridge wage gaps and tackle other major social issues in our community, millennial shaming was at its highest. Now that this candidate has lost the nomination, of course she's referring to Bernie Sanders, it could be argued that those who supported the victor of the nomination relaxed their shaming of millennials. This is the first time I've heard millennials talked about in the news since the nomination of the Democratic Party.
I think that there still is a candidate in the race that is supporting those things, and that candidate is also being supported by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and other champions of millennial issues. And this isn't the first I've heard of millennials being talked about in this election. Every election from at least maybe 2000 that I can remember, people are talking about the youth vote. It may not have been the millennials in 2000, but the youth vote is always an issue that is, if you can turn it up, if you can bring out the youth vote, then you are probably going to elect the more progressive candidate. And I think that there is a degree of millennial shaming. We've seen it in numerous instances. You see millennials responding back with cheeky videos online saying, oh, are we really the ones to blame? Our parents' generations are the ones who created economies that didn't pay us to work, that have created internships instead of paid jobs, that have made college unaffordable, and are creating huge amounts of student debt. And we're looking at, we're looking at the top of the ticket races where if that's an issue that's important to you, one candidate is supporting making college affordable for individuals and one candidate is not. I think that millennial shaming I didn't experience it personally, but I was supporting Hillary throughout the process, so maybe I was immune to it.
On a related note to the Democratic campaign, Mike says, I've spoken with many millennial age voters, and the majority of those have expressed a total disgust with what they feel is the DNC and Hillary Clinton's collusion in sabotaging Bernie Sanders' campaign. I fear that many will stay home on election day due to the perceived fixing of the primaries against Sanders. Hillary Clinton's campaign hinges on significant minority and millennial turnout. Unfortunately, this could be the deciding factor. So, Hoodie, I mean, I know you don't plan to vote. If Bernie Sanders had been the Democratic nominee for president, would you consider voting?
I don't know. I think so. I guess I would.
Mm-hmm. How would you have felt differently, all of you, if Bernie Sanders had been the candidate versus Hillary Clinton?
I think it's hard to tell, Megan, and I think part of that is because the Trump campaign is so different than any other campaigns that we don't know what type of rhetoric they would have thrown against
exactly.
Bernie. Would it have been anti-Semitic? Would it have been socialist? There's just the vitriol that is coming out of that campaign is unbelievable, and I think that we would have seen a different race that would have been having a higher degree of attacks in different realms. And I think Bernie ran a really steady race where he focused on issues. He didn't want to talk about nonsense. And I think that he'll be a great ally in the Senate, pushing what the Democrats have put forth is the most liberal agenda for any political party. And he helped write the entire policy for the Democratic Party. It was a big part of his concession in the primary. I know that part of what was being talked about is the sort of collusion between the DNC and the Clinton campaign, and I don't know that that will be easily mended for a lot of millennials who feel very upset about it. But I do know that there is, when you're looking at the candidates, I don't think that they're equally bad, no matter what. And I'm not really a big fan of people hating the Hillary Clinton, because I think she's a great candidate, and I don't look at her as being the lesser of two evils. I look at her as being a good choice.
We're down to our last minute. I wish we had more time, but 10 seconds each. If you are on the, if you're, we're speaking to people who may be on the fence about voting at all, or on the fence about being involved in political causes, what is your recommendation? Super quick, around the panel. Jessica.
Yes, I would definitely encourage people, millennials, everyone, please vote, because your voice matters.
Illy.
Yeah, I definitely think you should get out there and educate yourself and make a choice.
BJ.
Think about the Supreme Court.
And Hoodie.
Think more and educate.
Very good. Thank you all for joining me. Illy, Ali, Jessica Lewis, Hoodie Miller, BJ Scanlon, Dr. Ruth Milkman was on the phone with us earlier. Stay with us for our next hour on Connections, and you can find this podcast at wxxinews.org/connections.